So Sharon Geller, welcome to the show. Voiceover actor, actor, theater yes. as well. Outstanding, outstanding. Four times on SNL. We were talking offline, so I definitely want to talk about SNL because I'm a big fan of the Eddie Murphy days and the Phil Hartman days and those Dana Carvey days. So those were the highlights. But yeah. Sharon Geller, tell me a little bit more about who you are, what you do, what you've been up to.
Well, who I am is basically what you just said. I tend to do a lot of comedic spots. So I do drama as well, but many more comedic spots. I get cast in a lot of radio and TV commercials, either as a comedic character or lighthearted. And that's okay with me because comedy is my first love. I mean, I grew up loving comedy and comedy characters. I mean, Gilda Radner was one of my idols for the longest time on SNL. Yeah, so those old days were just magical. And and of course, Tracy Ullman. But back in the day, you know, I grew up loving Carol Burnett. And I used to watch that with my dad when I lived with my parents. So today, for the last, I'd say 25 years, I've been earning my living as a comedic actress, doing radio and TV commercials. I'm in the national touring company of an off-Broadway show called Old Jews Telling Jokes, which I absolutely love. And we can talk more about that later. But so a lot of what I do circles around comedy, and obviously it's had its challenges in the last year and a half for the well-known reasons, but I feel luckier than most.
Yeah, my wife's Jewish, and so we get a big kick, obviously, out of, you know, Seinfeld and then and Curb Your Enthusiasm. Old Jews Telling Jokes, that's going to have to be a watch.
Right, for sure. Well, you know, it's an homage. It's a tribute to the Borscht Belt. And if you're not familiar with that, the Borscht Belt is that area in the Catskill Mountains in New York that gave birth to all of those comedians like Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld, Buddy Hackett back in the day, of course, Milton Berle, you know, Mel Brooks, Woody Allen. So all of those Jewish comedians were spawned out of the Borscht Belt, because this was a time in the 50s and 60s when Jews actually were not allowed to entertain at other kinds of places. Jews were excluded. So the Borscht Belt was born, and that was in the Catskill Mountains, a series of hotels with entertainment at night. And all of that Jewish comedy that you're talking about, plus Old Jews Telling Jokes, it's like a nighted vaudeville. It's all of that Jewish humor that was spawned out of that era.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, my wife gives me a hard time. I wasn't Jewish before, maybe since I married her, you know, maybe I'm now. But, you know, watching Curb, she gives me a hard time. I'm probably the most vanilla Gentile person that she might have ever thought she'd marry. And yet she compares me to Larry David with my stubbornness and my bitterness and my refusal to, you know, relent and my refusal to admit I'm wrong. But I think not only is it, but I don't think that's necessarily like a Jewish guy thing. I think that's just a guy thing in general.
I was going to say, but you should end that sentence with, but she loves me anyway.
But she loves me anyway, of course.
Because you just decided, you just sounded like someone who I don't want to meet. That is very funny. And I think you're right. I think a lot of people can have that attribute, but because Larry David is so well known, now I know exactly what you mean when you say that type of personality.
Yeah. You know, in the show, Larry's Jewish, his wife's Gentile. She gives him a hard time. And they're, especially with this one episode where they're at this campfire with friends, and he left a jacket in his car. He left his car unlocked. Great. One of his wife's friends just went through his car, grabbed his jacket, and put it on because she's cold. And now he goes to look for it. It's not in there.
Yeah.
And he goes back and he sees her wearing it. And he's like, what the hell? Like, I'm gonna rip this one and I'm gonna rip this woman a new one. She's like, leave it alone. He goes, are you kidding me? This is my jacket. I brought my jacket. It was in my car. And she's just gonna walk around. And this whole episode. And now me and my wife's relationship is reversed when it comes to like the upbringing and the religion. And it would have been the same exact situation. Same exact situation.
Someone wrote a whole book, and I can't remember the person's name, about the difference between WASPs and Jews. And one of the things that stuck in my mind most is, let me see if I can get this saying right. WASPs leave a party and never say goodbye. And Jews say goodbye, but they never leave.
Yes.
And that is, yes, it's so indicative of you know, the Jewish mentality.
Yeah.
But anyway, you could appreciate that, I'm sure.
Yeah. There was a whole episode of Curb where it was like, don't you say goodbye? And he's like, yes, goodbye. I was going to say goodbye. Oh my God. Yeah. No, that rings true. So how, you know, you were talking a little bit about getting back into it. You've been doing this for 25 years. How have you been impacted the last year and a half?
Well, very much so, like everybody else. And, you know, when the pandemic first started, I mean, nobody is psychic, and I didn't know we'd be stuck like this for 18 months and counting. One of the first things that happened was, I teach comedy improvisation at the Walnut Street Theater in Philadelphia. And I had never heard of the word Zoom. Didn't know what it was. And yeah, I know it's embarrassing to admit, but it's true. And so I found out how to teach improv, which, you know, just blows my mind, because that in itself is an interactive discipline. And I thought, can I teach this on Zoom? That sounds like the antithesis. It's not like I'm teaching chemistry, you know? And I figured out a way to do it. Because, and to make it interesting, you know, I always feel, Glenn, that when I'm teaching, it's like hosting a party. You have to make sure everybody's engaged. You're the host. You got to make sure everybody's having a good time. Because if they're not, then they're not going to listen. And I feel like that when I teach in person. So you can imagine, like, it's tenfold when you're doing it on Zoom. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that I've been teaching for years, I could transfer over to a Zoom improv class. Other things I couldn't do at all. And some I just had to do what I teach in improv, which is think outside of the box and adapt. And I learned how to use Zoom, which I know sounds so like, oh, you're such a big girl, you learned how to use Zoom. It's like, yeah, well, you know, it's for someone who's not a techie, and that would be me. You know, knowing how to use Zoom and not being afraid of it was really a big step. Anyway, so I've been doing that. I teach an advanced comedy improv class for years. I've been doing that on Zoom. I've even been, I teach improv for lawyers at Drexel Law School, and improv and interview skills for neuroscientists at the University of Pennsylvania. All of those things I've continued online. Plus, there's a show that I do, and I do one performance, one program that I do is for lawyers. It's a CLE, which is continuing legal education. And that is called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Arbitration. And that's something I've done for 15 years in person, and I transferred that to Zoom. And then I do a show for Jewish groups, synagogues, Jewish federations called Knock Knock, Jews There, A Talmudic Take on Comedy. And it's all about the importance of laughter and humor in Judaism, with examples from the Torah and the Talmud, which with a lot of Borscht Belt stuff thrown in. So yeah, so all of that stuff I've managed to continue doing on Zoom. But I have to tell you, before any of that happened back a year and a half ago, the first thing I thought is, okay, we're not going to be stuck that long like this. So, but what can I do? I want to do something creative. And the first thing that occurred to me was, how are people doing internet dating? I mean, how do you meet someone for a date when half your face is covered with a mask? Right. So I just, you know, I've written comedy sketches, and I And I had this great idea. Meanwhile, I have a partner who's very funny in Israel. She's a very funny comedian. She does a lot of TikTok stuff. She works for a big radio station in Israel. And she calls me one day. She says, Sharon, I want to write something with you. And I said, you know, I'm already writing a sketch. Why don't we do it together? And I called it coronamatch.com. And it's like an SNL parody of internet dating, because it's all about how do you find your one true love when you're covered with a mask, and the benefits of that happening. So I had sent you that link. I don't know if you had a chance to look at the 3-minute parody, but it's a pretty funny link, and got a ton of compliments on it and views. So I was just trying to stay creative. This is a long answer to a short question. I was just trying to stay creative by writing that, and I was in it, I performed it, I cast it, you know, just to get the creative juices flowing. And then sometime after that is when all the Zoom teaching and performing started.
Yeah. And you know, going back to the voiceover work, I think I did one or two voiceovers throughout the quarantine. You mentioned, you know, kind of foreseeing the quarantine. And I'm such a big movie buff. I've seen the movie Contagion. I've seen all these zombie movies. I've seen all, I've seen Take Shelter. And I just happened to watch the movie Take Shelter again, starring Michael Shannon and Jessica Chastain, which is a mind-blowing, incredible independent film. Definitely worth a watch. I watched it for the second time last night, but I've seen all those things. And so I heard about this and I saw how they were kind of making a big deal about it. So I started getting ready, started hunkering down, worked my last couple of gigs. But luckily for me, whether it be luck, whether it be hindsight, whether it just be I'm blessed, you know, and I think it's a combination of all three, is that I've always delved into the live streaming aspect of audio, video, film, and TV, live streaming, some remote work. I've always been trying to work my way to a career that was working from home, mostly. Have a home studio, me and some partners failed at the podcast twice before.
Right.
And I was hearing about Zoom and looking at the prices, and Zoom would have been the best option for us to pull off this podcast before. Then, of course, quarantine happens. It's like, yeah, I mean, there's nothing going on. Might as well pay that premium price.
Right.
Make, you know, kick off this podcast once again, try to make that happen. Right. And this has been going on. There was a lot of passion projects I shot, had in the can, just started knocking them out, started editing and putting stuff out, because I didn't have the time to edit these passion projects, because on gig, set to set, event, it was nonstop, and it was great money, and I love set life. I cannot stand editing, but when it comes to these passion projects and there's no money, it's like, listen, I'm gonna have to edit it myself because I can't afford an editor. I'm good at it, right. I can't stand it. But you know, maybe I kind of saw it coming in such a way that it was like, when it hits, we're gonna be set. If it doesn't, I'll be right back on set. If it does hit, I got stuff I can do here, and I'll be,
I'm just the opposite of you, because I know that I can do things from here, but I would always much rather be performing out in the world. First of all, I love doing theater, live theater. We know what's happened to that in the last year and a half. Mm-hmm. And so that's really been hard. The voiceover work that I've done over the last year and a half, I've done by going into a professional studio, and I was asked to do that. And I said, yeah, you know, at this point where everybody's vaccinated and I'm there with one engineer, totally like a football stadium studio, so I feel totally safe doing that. But I'm the exact opposite. People used to say to me before the pandemic, if I had an audition in New York, or why would you go up to New York for a voiceover audition when you can just self-submit, you know, save yourself like a trip? I'd say, because I would always rather be in person and meet the casting director and meet the people in the room, because nothing beats personal connection. And then you get to get feedback and direction from the client who's in the room. Could you do that again, but like a little slower? Or could you do that again with more energy?
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, I can self-submit and give them the best copy that I did. And that's nice too. I can do it 10 times before I send them one. But then I'm trying to be psychic. What do they want? What I'm trying to please them and give them the best job. And it would be much better if I was in the room with them and doing it. So I always feel like I would rather be out there person to person, but no one asked me what I wanted. So before the pandemic began. So I'm just trying to roll with the punches like everybody else.
Yeah. You know, as far as acting goes, you know, my military and my military police experience, you know, having done that in the military has been my acting. And I know my strengths as an actor. Mm-hmm. Going back to, like, you know, living for set life, I started dabbling into acting, only playing law enforcement or military roles for the sake of, all right, there's no AD gigs right now. There's no camera op gigs. I got a big chunk of open space on my schedule. So I just started applying to acting roles as a detective this, officer that, lieutenant this, you know, sergeant that, whatever the case, law enforcement and or military roles. And that started filling in the schedule. And then when it came to the self-submits, again, I know my strengths. An actress like yourself could play a whole variety of things. But me, I'm going to hone in on where my strengths are, law enforcement, military. I'm going to apply to all those. And yes, I could spend an hour driving to an audition, spend 2 hours at this whole audition, maybe 3 hours at this whole audition process, drive an hour back. That's been 5 hours of my day, whereas I can knock out 10 self-submits in 5 hours at home, because really, it's just going to be me playing detective this,
right,
in 1960s, or sergeant that in a futuristic post-apocalyptic, right, or anywhere in between law enforcement, military roles. And what you see is what you get. It's going to be the real life, you know, Staff Sergeant Nelson from the military.
Right.
As far as crew goes, that military experience, you know, they want to AD, they want to, you know, you don't have to, you don't really have to audition for the crew work. You have to have a decent resume. And, right, and that military experience is always kind of a boost on that crew resume. But in my case, for a lot of actors, maybe starting off, just churn out those self-submits. With modern, and again, even pre-COVID, modern technology, self-submits. I would churn out, you know, probably 100 self-submits a week, but maybe go to one audition, two auditions in person a week. But right, my schedule was steadily filled with acting gigs. And then it got to a point where casting directors or ADs or producers would call me direct and be like, hey, we need you to fill in. Can you fill in these days? And we you know, negotiate the schedule. Yeah, I didn't have to audition because I know my strengths. They know my strengths. They wanted it last minute. They called me in. But that schedule started to get steadily filled with acting work with a particular character. Every once in a while, I would get that killer, that perp or that killer role, or the stepfather role, you know, the generic stepfather. And I'm more than happy. Cause like you said, that set life was the life, man. Just like bouncing from set to set, doing different things here and there and anywhere and everywhere in between. But again, also having those technical skills of say, live streaming and knowing Zoom and editing. Thank God, because that's when the quarantine did happen. It's like, hey, let's, you know, I got to stay active. Got to stay creative. Let's talk to, you know, fellow creatives like you that ain't doing shit for the last 6 months and it sucks. Let's talk about what you were doing. Let's talk about how you're, you know, staying creative and productive now. What's next on the plate? And just share, you know, good stories, bad stories, and everything in between, and make that the thing during the quarantine. And
right.
Yeah, I mean,
what you're saying, both of your stories illustrate that necessity is the mother of invention, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe you and I are both doing things now that we might not have chosen to do before the pandemic, or in this style to do the thing, but not in the style. And we're just, you know, trying to make lemonade out of lemons.
Yep.
I know I would always rather return to in-person gigs. And for a while, like back in June, when it was safe, when everybody was vaccinated, I did a few in-person gigs. I did a comedy improv show with a corporate team that I do for a big international group. It was outside. It worked perfectly. Everybody was vaccinated. I did another thing at a senior upscale retirement community. again, everybody's vaccinated, I feel safe, everything is great. And then of course the Delta variant comes. Right. So we're all just making it up as we go along and trying to figure out what's safe, what's not safe, and you know, just making sure that we can continue to do what we love in a very safe way, because of course nobody wants to get sick.
Obviously, yeah.
I constantly feel like I'm just like making it up as I go along. Improv, what I teach, you know, I'm just making it up as I go along, and my behavior gets dictated by the science.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more on the behavior being dictated by the science. Right. But you know, for me, there's always like, okay, there's this workaround. I can still finish these projects somehow. Right. Let's experiment. And that's the biggest, and that's one big thing for me that some of my colleagues, it drives them nuts. Like, what the hell are you doing now? I'm like, let's experiment. Let's see what we can pull off with Zoom. Let's see what we can pull off. If you're on, you just happen to be at the beach in Virginia and I'm in the woods in Maryland, you shoot some stuff, I shoot some stuff. We'll see what comes together with it, you know, whatever. And see what we can make out of it. But
I'll tell you what, I am constantly amazed in my comedy improv classes, the creativity that has come out of the Zoom performances. I never would have thought until I saw it how creative people can be. I mean, I think when we're forced to literally think outside of the box, we really can. Because yeah. I have seen stuff that would have never happened if I was teaching in person. So the creativity and the thinking outside of the box, which is just another way of saying problem solving, mm-hmm. you know, all of that stuff that I see in my comedy improv classes are fantastic. That SNL parody, not SNL parody, but that SNL type parody that I did called coronamatch.com about dating during the pandemic, that would have been something I never would have done if I hadn't been locked down.
Right.
With thinking, what can I do that's creative? And, you know, thanks to my partner, Avishag Yadeh in Israel, who did such a great job of editing that and adding in sound and things like that, we come up with this creative thing. We never would have done it. I'm sure we never would have done it had we not been forced to think outside of the box. So a lot of this stuff is like, when you're creative, it's hard anyway in this country to be a self-employed creative person, because unless you're at the top of the totem pole, you know, everybody understands what Robert De Niro and Meryl Streep do, but most people don't understand how you can earn a living doing medical industrials and voiceovers on the lower end of that ladder, right? Mm-hmm. So because people don't know your name. So, I mean, there are ways to do it, obviously, but I remember many times in my life when people would say to me, what do you do for a living? And I say, I'm an actor. And like, what do you mean? And I'm an actor, I do, right? And they don't understand, yeah. So I have to give them an example, because they understand, oh, you do radio commercial, oh, you do TV, you know, so they understand that. You have to give them something concrete, which, you know, sometimes you have to do, you have to explain who you are.
Yeah, you got to explain it. Like, you actually have to explain it. You actually have to, sometimes you might actually have to explain it differently these days. How are you still an actor or whatever?
Well, this is true.
Yeah.
And you know, it's something funny that you said in the beginning about whether it was luck or blessings or a little bit of thinking outside of the box or everything. I feel that way too. I mean, listen, all of my life, I used to be in the corporate world for 10 years before I started acting full time. Mm-hmm. And once I started acting full time, all my life, I thought, gee, wouldn't it be cool to shoot a national TV commercial? I would just love to do that. And the day before lockdown, I shot a national TV commercial. And what a blessing that was, not just to have done that and had a great experience on set with wonderful actors, but to have shot a national TV commercial that is a union residual paying job. What a wonderful time to be getting residual checks.
Right.
I mean, it's such a blessing that it just happened to fall out that way. Mm-hmm. I always feel so grateful for everything that I get, because it's such a blessing to be able to earn your living doing what you love and not have to like gruel away doing something that you hate. So many people are trapped in jobs for different reasons. I remember reading this article once, Jay Leno said to someone as a response to how he got to be who he is. And he said, listen, I used to hang out on a corner with like five other friends, and we were all very funny. Both some of them were funnier than me, he said. But this is what happened. Life gets in the way. So this one got married and had a baby. And obviously you got responsibilities, right? When you have a family. And this one went off and did something else. And he said, so what would happen is I'd call up these friends because we always did the midnight set at the comedy club. And I'd call them up and I'd say, hey, you going tonight to the old fashioned phone. You going tonight to that midnight set. And they would say, oh, I have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. Oh, I didn't know you got a full time. Yeah, I needed health insurance for the kid. You know, so life gets in the way. And understandably so, if you have a kid, you have responsibilities. There's no question about it. But he said that he was always so diligent and so driven that, you know, that's how he got to be where he is. And I think that you have to have an element of that. It's hard to juggle everything, but I think that that's some of what goes into it.
Yeah, it's a lonely road. And, you know, I really started to, you know, get my film and acting career off the ground about 2015 or 2017 maybe. And late 2016 is when I met my now wife. And, you know, we were dating and, you know, things, it was steadily, you know, kind of, but the 36 years prior to that, I stayed diligent with, you know, it's a lonely road. If you want to do what you want to do and do it well, and especially when it comes to filmmaking, it comes to music, it comes to acting. I mean, it's a lonely road until you really kick off that career. And that's what it was. And, you know, I had gotten back from a deployment and I just hit the ground running with acting and more film gigs, more crew work, more acting work, live events, anything and everything I could jump in, and started getting that ball rolling, started getting on people's, you know, first call list when it came to acting, crew and live events. And then I met her and things were continually growing and being stable as a full-time freelance filmmaker and actor. It was stable as we got engaged and then got married and then had a kid. That was the career. But before that, the 36 years, the 37 years before that, it was a lonely road.
Well, so this is a matter of timing. And you actually just said that because, listen, I was in the corporate world for 10 years in medical public relations, and I would write press releases and public service announcements and book doctors on TV shows. And I love that. In the back of my mind, I always loved acting, but I honestly didn't think I could earn a living doing it, or I didn't understand how. And it's not because I didn't have confidence in myself. I just didn't understand how you could do that unless you were, you know, Meryl Streep or Robert De Niro. So over those 10 years, and I grew to, from loving that job, loving being in the corporate world, and because I was in the creative part of the corporate world, I was writing press releases, public service announcements, booking documents, to hating it because I was like, I am so trapped in this building and I think I'm going to scream. Right. And I always believed, like, you know, timing is everything. So then one day my dad unfortunately passed away. And that was my wake up call to life is short. And I don't want to be 50 one day and say woulda, shoulda, coulda. And if I die tomorrow, am I happy doing what I'm doing? And I said, the answer is no. So I knew that I had to make a change. So what I did is I took a day off from work. I went up to my mom's, and at the time, Phil Donahue, the brilliant talk show host, had a show on at 9 a.m. in the morning. I watched it that day. Just so happens I was off from work. And what was his guest? His guests were six CEOs who all left their six-figure income jobs to pursue their heart's content. And I listened to that show, Glenn, and I said to myself, you know what? I'm not making six figures and I hate what I'm doing. And Monday morning, I went into work and gave notice, but I'm not a fly-by-night person. So yes, I gave notice, but I gave myself a month to leave. And because I knew if I said it, then it would be true. And by the end of that month, I was gone. And I was so scared of being self-employed. My three biggest fears in working for myself, I was afraid that every day I'd sleep until noon.
Right.
I was afraid I'd have mint chocolate chip ice cream for breakfast. And I was afraid I'd watch soap operas all day long.
Right.
And I was so scared of those things happening with no structure except what I provided, that I did the antithesis. I made myself get up every day at 6 o'clock in the morning, get out for coffee and fresh fruit and toast or whatever, and then go to the gym and then read the newspaper while I was having breakfast. So I, if nothing else happened by noon every day, I knew what was going on in the world. I was mm-hmm. out in the world. I was talking to people and I was up and out. And I swear to you, Glenn, since I left the corporate world, I've never slept until noon. I've never had mint chocolate chip ice cream for breakfast, and I've never watched soap operas all day long. So I feel like, you know, that was my way. That was my plan, because it's hard when you don't have that structure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, exactly. I would get up and it would be, you know, 100 applications every other day. Mm-hmm. The day I wasn't doing the applications, you know, I would be editing something, or I would be writing something, or I'd be at the, you know, I'd be at the gym, or I would, you know, be doing something else. But it was, I would always start the day off with emails and gig applications nonstop. And and then it was the next thing. Okay. If there was a gig that day, the gig was first. And I might, if we have downtime and if I have the capabilities, I take my laptop to that gig. Right. And I would do the applications there. So yeah. I mean, I've never been busier being full-time freelance, and it keeps you motivated. Being that busy keeps you motivated to stay even busier.
I so agree, because I always say to people, when I'm not working, I'm marketing myself. Mm-hmm. And that was the other part of that, you know, leaving the corporate world. So then I would spend the afternoon after I had breakfast and I went to the gym and I read the newspaper, if I knew what current events were, I'd spend the rest of the day marketing. So let me do one thing for myself that's about either sending out a resume, sending out a headshot, getting an audit, something that was there. And then right to this day, I do the same thing. I'm always marketing myself. And I remember when I was going for my radio, TV, and film degree back at Temple University in communications, my BS in communications, I remember someone came to speak to us who was like a local news person from one of the TV stations. And she said, first of all, you'll always be working if you have your own project. So don't depend on other people. Don't wait for other people to hire you. Have something that you can take out there that you do. That's number one. And number two, don't sit back on your laurels and wait for your agent to call you, because you will get much more work if you're always, you know, pounding the pavement. And I've always done that. I mean, my agents have been great in getting me stuff, but if I just had sat at home waiting for the phone to ring, I wouldn't do any of the things I'm doing, half the things I'm doing, right? Because a lot of it is what you just said, being self-motivated. You have to be marketing yourself. You have to be looking for the next job, whether it's a live corporate event or whether it's, you're marketing yourself in with the producers and directors you already shot something with, and you want to remind them that you're still alive. You know, it's always something that you're doing to make sure that your name is out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So you were talking a little bit about this theater company, I believe, this performance or this class you were doing back in June. Have you been back on set? Have you been back on stage? Have you been back in the studio? And if so, doing what?
Well, one in-person gig that I did was I just recorded 4 voiceovers for Medicare, which was lovely. It was so great to be back in the studio. Mm-hmm. And again, that was this huge studio with one engineer, and I felt totally safe. And it was a great, it was just great to be there, you know, to not be doing it in my house, but to be going out on set, and as it were, and doing that voiceover. I had an in-person gig doing my own show, Knock Knock, Jews There, a Talmudic take on comedy, at an upscale retirement community in Voorhees, New Jersey. And that was really well received. And again, it felt great to be out. I had another one for that international company I told you about. It was a comedy improv gig to help people think outside of the box. And that was totally safe, because that one was actually outside of where the company is. So that was a really safe space. So little by little, it's creeping up, but creeping back into the live in-person stuff. But you know, next week or in 2 weeks, I'm slated to do a show in person. I've got another thing I do with this Betsy Ross, where she talks about her life as Betsy Ross in colonial garb. And it's a mix and mingle walk around. It's an interactive live event. And I was just asked about that, and that's for September. And who knows what's going to happen with the Delta variant? I don't know if their gig's going to get canceled, or even if everyone's vaccinated. We already know what's happening with the Delta variant being more potent. So I don't know what's going to happen with that. But those are the kinds of things that I have been doing. You know, the radio commercials, the voiceovers, the theater stuff, the improv stuff. So yeah, it's been, and next week I'm supposed to be doing something for Drexel, for Improv for Lawyers.
Okay.
So, you know, we're hoping for the best, but again, who knows?
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. So what's next? You mentioned what's next on your agenda, some of your future projects. What drives you? What's your driving force? What drives you?
To pay my bills. It's true. But aside from that, I love what I do so much. I love doing comedic characters and making people laugh. It's just, I can't even explain. I feel I get so much more from my performances than my audiences do, even though they're so appreciative and they are so positive with their feedback and comments. It's just something that puts me in the most positive frame of mind. And I love contributing. I would never, like my accountant said to me, when are you going to retire? And I said, I should retire from something I love doing. I said, what do you think? I am an accountant.
Right.
I don't want to retire from anything I love doing. So what drives me is I love what I do. I mean, it's very addictive when you love something so much that you feel like you have to do it. I love making people laugh. I love doing old Jews telling jokes, because singing, there's a great song, Tom Lehrer, I don't know if you know the songwriter, wrote this really funny song called I'm Spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica. And it's a really funny song. And I love singing funny lyrics and making people laugh. And I just love the connection of being in the same room with people. And even when I'm doing my voiceover that I did last week, it was just the engineer and me, but the five clients were patched in by phone. And it's just really nice to get it right, to be told that that's exactly what someone was looking for, or that's the kind of feel we want. It's just really nice, because it means honing your craft and getting to what the client wants and what sounds good and what most benefits them. So that's what drives me. I mean, I'm very motivated by that. I'm sure some Freudian psychologists will tell you this all has to do with when I was growing up, my father and I would listen. He was a big TV watcher, and my father was very funny, and he would always tell jokes, and we'd watch the Carol Burnett show together, and we'd laugh at all the funny characters that she did, and everything. I mean, my father loved like sitcoms, everything from The Honeymooners to the Red Skelton Show. So now I'm dating myself, but the point is that
that's okay.
You know, yeah. I mean, I'm sure the fact that my father and I were laughing together at that stuff had a lot to do with how, you know, comedy makes people feel and how fun it is to have a shared laughing experience with someone. I'm sure that had a lot to do with it, but that's not the only reason. I just happen to love it too. I mean, I'm also not good at math. I would never be a mathematician or a scientist, because I really suck at those two things. But I was always drawn to that because of those people like Gilda Radner and Tracy Ullman. And those characters were very infectious. Those first 7 years of Saturday Night Live were just amazing. It was a magical time. And I can remember so vividly like the Eddie Murphy moments and the Phil Hartman and just, oh man, it's so many great sketches. And I remember this is a time when everybody stayed home on Saturday night at 11:30 because you didn't want to miss Saturday Night Live. That was where it's at. And that was a really big part of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you hit the nail on the head, and I know I've mentioned it on my show a million times. And you kind of helped me like put it in the perfect kind of quotable quote, you know, those quotes that goes on, you know, pictures or whatever, pay your bills doing what you love.
Right.
And that's always been my goal. Right. That's success to me is, you know, there's a lot of people that, you know, do music on the side and yeah, I'm a musician. And it's like, dude, I pay my bills doing what I love. And I've had some colleagues, I've had some former colleagues where I said, you know, some were musicians and some wanted to be, you know, DJs, like, you know, live DJs at clubs or whatever. And I said, listen, I've got all these AV gigs and they're looking for, you know, audio technicians, and you're just laying XLR cable, you know, for hours.
Yeah,
and right. you're hanging speakers and you're hanging lights.
Right.
And you're plugging in microphones, man. I'm not trying to do all that, man. That's and the pay is really good, man. I'm not trying to do all that. I'm a musician. I'm a DJ. I'm a filmmaker. I'm a camera operator. I'm like, okay, fast forward 5 years. I know how to mic up my own voiceover deck
yeah.
in my basement because right. of all these gigs and all these little technical, you know, expertises that I've gathered over the right. past 5-10 years. I know how to set up a podcast. I know how to dabble. Now I have like this little DJ set, and I know how to dabble with this DJ set. I know how to, I'm further experienced in camera operation and stuff like that from these, some might say, god-awful boring expos and conferences and seminars at this convention center, at that convention center, at this hotel, at the grand ballroom of that hotel. Those, right. those seminars and those expos, but they got a couple camera setups and microphones. It's being live streamed to their website or being live streamed to their YouTube. And I've learned so much that now I'm actually doing what you say you do.
Right.
But I learned so many skills. I've learned so much extra stuff from the set, from these events.
Right. And I can relate to that because it's so funny how the things we learn along the way, along the journey of our life, like mm-hmm. when I was in public relations for 10 years and writing press releases and public service announcements, and then I'm not because I'm acting full time. Guess what I do since I'm an actress?
Right.
I do follow up. It used to be sending out picture postcards. If this is in public relations, I don't know what is. When I used to send out like a 5x7 picture postcard of my headshot for every job I had to like every casting director and producer or director I worked with on that set. Hi, I just wanted to thank you for a wonderful experience. Hope we can work together again soon. Here's what I've been up to in the last month.
Right.
One radio commercial, one TV, you know, and then they get that in the mail. Of course, now I do it by email. They get that in the mail and then it's like, oh yeah, that's that girl we worked with 2 weeks ago on that set. So all of those PR skills that I learned in those 10 years, that served me well for doing follow-up once I became an actress and the importance of making sure your name is forefront, you know, making right. sure that it's there. And the other thing is, I always said, look, if I'm teaching a comedy improv class, I might rather be performing, but at least I'm teaching comedy improv, which in itself is so related to performing. I mean, if you're, as a teacher, if you're not performing, I don't know what is, but trying to make sure everyone's having a good right. time and making sure everyone's engaged. So at least I'm doing that. I'm not being a secretary, and nothing against secretaries.
Nothing against secretaries, nothing against,
at all.
Nothing against data administrators, nothing
I
against.
Did, yeah, but, I was a secretary in a production place for a couple of years, so I have nothing against secretaries.
Right.
But I mean, at least teaching comedy improv is related to performing. So I
yeah.
feel like what you're just saying, everything that I'm doing is related to what I want to do.
Yeah. And you, even you teaching it, you'll get students that challenge you and you'll learn something.
Always. People
Always.
Ask me all the time. They would say, even before the pandemic, when I used to like, sometimes I'd run up to New York. I studied for 5 years with Chicago City Limits in New York, which is kind of like what Second City is to Chicago, Chicago City Limits is to New York. So it's a comedy improv training ground and sketch group. And I studied with them for 5 years. And people used to say to me, you're still taking classes or you go up to New York to take class? And
I would say, I do.
Yeah, like I don't know everything there is to know.
Exactly.
And if I felt like I did, shame on me. Like, how can you know everything there is to know? And plus, when you study with different directors or different teachers, you learn something you never knew before.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that stuff is then I can then pass it on to when I'm teaching. So there's always something new to learn. I don't think I know everything there is to know. And I hate that I can't do that during the pandemic. But of course, what I can take advantage of is our Zoom classes that, you know, I can Zoom in from anywhere and learn a skill or learn something new or keep my juices, hone my creativity so that I don't feel I'm going stale.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And for me, it's a little bit different. You know, like I took some acting class, I guess, in high school and, you know, did some drama stuff in high school. And I worked with some, we didn't work with any drama students. I never really took any acting classes. And so for me, the acting is the military police experience. But for me, and just for right now, for me, I don't have time for the classes. I got to get the gig after gig after gig after gig. And then, you know, get the ball rolling on that and then bigger gigs and better gigs. Right. And then I can, maybe I can take some time being a father, that time is taken away. So, but sure. At some point, maybe there's time, like, hey, maybe I can take a couple of these, what do you call them? Those acting seminars, those acting, workshops. Thank you. The acting workshop here and there.
Yeah.
But there's no point. I know where my skills are right now. There's no point right now.
Right.
The point right now is to fill in that schedule, get the gig.
Totally agree.
Law enforcement, military roles. I'm your guy.
Yep.
I've done it in real life. I've done it a million times on screen. Here's my reel. Here's my proof.
Right.
I won't let you down. Right. When it comes to, you know, more in-depth leading roles of really in-depth character. Now there's better, more experienced, more versatile actors out there for that. But you want that badass cop. You got it. You want that great interrogation scene. You know, those interrogation scenes and those crime thrillers and those crime shows, you know, I can nail that. But
well, you have on the job training and then
OJT. Yeah.
Yeah. There's something to be said for that, too.
Yeah. So, you know, March 12th, 2020 was when Maryland was put on lockdown. So March 12th, 2021 was really more like the new year for me, not January 1st, right?
Right.
But now here we are, it's, you know, well past August. But and then we had this whole word, the new normal.
Right.
And then with New Year's, you know, there's this phrase, the new you, the new year, new you. But if I were to say, what's the new normal, new you? The new year, new normal, new you. What comes to mind? The new normal, new you.
Well, some of the things that I want to do, like continuing my studies online, I mean, I will do that if I find that I'm in a situation where, hey, we're back to wearing masks again. We're waiting to see what happens with the Delta variant. I mean, I have gigs booked in the next month that I don't know if they're going to happen or not, because they're in person. Right. I have other gigs booked that are online, which obviously will happen. So a lot of this is just, again, making it up as we go along and figuring out what's the best choice for me to make for considering, you know, health considerations, because, you know, the health is, of course, the most important thing. So insofar as the new me, I mean, I was hoping, had the Delta variant not presented itself, that I would have gotten back to like auditioning more in New York or auditioning, you know, more for different gigs that I want. Now we have to see, because what the reality is that a lot of casting directors are very happy with the online submissions. They don't have to rent studio space to meet people in person. And it's a very safe way to audition. So I have to acknowledge that that's the reality right now. So whether it means sending in a self-submission tape, you know, for a voiceover or for on camera, that's where we are right now. So as much as I would love for it to go back in person, nobody's asking me what I want. and we have to just go with the flow. So if that's what it has to be, then that's what it has to be.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. And it's going to be, it's not going to be as long as the whole year, you know, the whole Delta variant thing. For sure. It's only going to be like an additional month or two.
I think you're
hopefully,
right.
Hopefully the vaccinations start, you know, going up and people start getting that and we work our way towards herd immunity, but it's not the end of the world. Even the Delta, even the quarantine wasn't the end of the world, as you can see, and we're all still here. And the Delta variant will be even less of a situation than the main thing was.
But, I think you're right. And I think the booster shot, which we're talking about this whole week, I think that's going to change the playing field. Mm-hmm. So look, it's, you know, even back before we even knew about the vaccine, I said way back when at the beginning of this, I said, this is not going to go on forever because we're going to have a vaccine by the end of the year. And friends of mine said, like, you're crazy. It takes 5 years to get through FDA and blah, 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 blah. And I said, look, I'm not psychic, but this much I know. This thing, this coronavirus, is affecting every nation in the world, every person in the world. And, I always feel like it's going to a theater on opening night. You can call the theater and they could say we're completely sold out. We don't have any seats left. And that could be true. But I can guarantee you that if the president of the United States and his wife want to attend opening night, somehow two seats miraculously appear. And that's exactly the way I felt about the corona vaccine. I said, I know it takes 5 years to go through FDA. I know. But here's what I think. Everybody in the world is being affected by this. I can't believe that there are not scientists at work coming up with something that we're going to have by the end of the year. And not because I'm so smart or I'm psychic, I just thought it has to be. And there was, and then it was. So I agree with you. I don't think it's going to be as bad as the initial thing. And the boosters are going to help. They already have them in Israel and we're going to have them here. And then that's going to help. So I do believe that it's going to go back to being a new normal, but I do think it will go back and it's not going to last as long as the first one did.
The big word in that is normal.
Yeah.
Just what relax. The new normal, old normal, it's still going to be normal. It's not going to be like living in our basements for the rest of the rest of our lives. So
I totally agree with you. I think that, and we take safe risks too. Like, I mean, I've been very conservative the last year and a half before the vaccine with masks. But one thing I did every day was I walked every day with a friend. I have a bunch of friends who live near me and I would walk for 2 or 3 hours every day. Why? Because I used to go to the gym, which I totally didn't want to go to anymore. I haven't been there since March 2020. I used to go there 3 times a week to work out, lift weights, blah, blah, blah. Guess what? Even when they reopened in April 2020, I said to myself, they're not reopening because it's safe. They're reopening because they need money. Yeah. I'm not going back to a gym. I don't care what size the gym is, where people are breathing heavy on machines and working out. That doesn't sound safe to me. So I said to a friend of mine, you know what? At the end of this pandemic, people are either going to be very fat or very skinny. And I said, I am not going to end up in the hospital because I'm sick or for any reason related to being sick. So I just decided every day I'd be walking 2 or 3 hours. And I kept that up. And it made me feel great. And it made me feel like at least I'm doing something, you know, how your physical affects your mental outlook. Yeah. And I felt great doing that, being out in the air. So when I'm out in the air walking, no mask, even back in March 2020, no mask because we're outside. Inside was a different story. And so now here we are and I'm still walking 2 to 3 hours every day because I'm not going back to my gym.
Yeah. So before I let you go, we're almost coming up on an hour. Before I let you go, I want to hear one or two awesome SNL stories.
Well, I have two to come to mind right immediately. First of all, I'm very lucky because every time I was on SNL, it was a different experience. The first one, which is always the most memorable one, is Amy Poehler and I were Icelandic delegates at the UN. Chris Parnell was playing Colin Powell. And it was thrilling because it was the very first time I was on. And it was the opening sketch, which is to say that means you're on the set, you know, doing that opening sketch. And then you're there when that sketch ends and they say, live from New York, it's Saturday night. And the band kicks in. Glenn, I have to tell you, I had chills going down my spine because all I could think of was, oh my God, I am sitting right where Gilda Radner sat. I am in Studio 8H at NBC, 30 Rockefeller. I mean, I'm here. It was thrilling to be in a sketch with Amy Poehler. And the opening sketch, I was so scared the sketch might get cut because you know how they do those things. You come in on a Saturday, they write all those sketches that are very current. Mm-hmm. And then you do it for the first audience, which is not the broadcast audience at 8:30. You do it for the first studio audience that comes in. Then when they leave, Lauren Michaels cuts all the sketches that didn't fly. Right. And then at 10 o'clock, the new studio audience that you see at home comes in. And that's when you do that one for the So in between, you don't know if your sketch is going to continue. You don't know if you're going to like be in it. So when I found out that I was, I didn't tell anybody because I was afraid, what if my sketch gets caught? And I said, hey, everybody, watch me on set. You know, so I only told my sister. And the next morning, because it didn't get cut, I got calls from people saying, call me crazy, but did I see you on Saturday Night Live in the opening sketch last night? And I was like, yeah, that was me.
Yeah.
So that was thrilling, Glenn, because that was the very first time.
And that's that bonus payment.
Oh,
From doing this work and struggling with this work. That's that bonus payment.
Amazing. You're not kidding. Yeah. And then the second time I was on, I was on a different SNL Weekend Update, and I play Martha Stewart in real life. Had just gotten indicted, and I played a WASPy Connecticut woman. it was really funny. Anyway, the very last time I was on was 2007. This is a great story because Kanye West was the musical guest, mm-hmm. and James was the host. Kanye West, I'm in a sketch that Seth Meyers, who was the head writer at the time, had written, and the sketch goes like this. I'm a Midwestern mom. We're at a county fair. My daughter just won a pumpkin contest, and she's about to get a blue ribbon by the county mayor, played by not Will Arnett, but oh my gosh, his name escapes me. Tall, thin guy. Anyway, he's wearing the mayor, you know, the blue ribbon, and he's about to give her the blue ribbon, my little 8-year-old daughter. And Kanye West comes in from nowhere and goes, hell no. And he grabs that ribbon out of her hand and goes on spurting about how this belongs to him. Now, in hindsight, when I used to tell that story about this funny sketch that Seth Meyers wrote, I would always say, Kanye West have a wonderful sense of humor about having ripped the award out of Taylor Swift's hand at the MTV Awards, because that, of course, was a parody of that, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody remembers when he ripped the award. So get this. One night I'm watching Late Night with Seth Meyers, like this is like in the last year, and Seth Meyers is talking about the sketch he wrote for Kanye West. It's the one I'm in. And he shows a little blip. And then he says this, can you believe that we wrote that sketch in 2007 and Kanye West didn't rip that award out of Taylor Swift's hand until 2009? So I was psychic, says Seth Meyers, because that hadn't even happened yet. So it was so funny, Glenn.
That sketch probably gave Kanye the idea to do it.
That's what Seth Meyers said. It probably gave him the idea to do that. So that was like just amazing to be in that sketch, because we did it like 5 times. We shot it because it was one of those sketches where it wasn't live.
Yeah, it's pre-recorded.
Yeah, we were in like Thursday to pre-record. So we did it like 5 different times. And it's always a challenge to know, what can I do that can add to the sketch without stealing focus? Like the sketch is clearly not about me. It's Kanye West. It's my daughter, you know, ripping the thing. But I was like, what can I do? And I thought of some silent bits I could do that I thought would add to the humor. And that's the one that they went with, that one where I added some stuff. So I was so pleased that it worked, and that to be in that sketch, something written by Seth Meyers, brilliant. I love, even now, I love watching him every night. Such a brilliant comedian and a monologuist, you know? So that was the biggest thrill, just those two things. And then outside of Saturday Night Live, to have just shot this national TV commercial was a thrill for Colonial Penn Life Insurance. And I mean, so many like lovely things, but definitely Saturday Night Live, since that was always my thing growing up, that was a real, real treat.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Sharon, I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing your stories and sharing your stories. Sharon, you should use that. Sharon stories or something like that. But I can't thank you enough for coming on. Wasps and Jews getting along, talking on a podcast.
Anything's possible.
Well,
in the world, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, before I let you go, any links, plugs, socials you wanna put out there?
Sure. Anyone can visit my website at sharongeller.com. You can see a whole bunch of stuff that I've done. You can find me on Facebook. It would be a pleasure if you want to give me a shout out and say hello. And I've also got, of course, the YouTube channel, the mandatory YouTube channel, Sharon Geller. We'll see a lot of different corporate events that I do and different things that I do. So a whole myriad of different things. And feel free to check in and say hi, and I'll say hi back.
Hell yeah. Well, Sharon, viewers, links are in the description below. And Sharon, don't go anywhere. We'll talk a little bit offline before we close. To the viewers out there, if you want to become an honorary member of the Zombie Squad, send me some, hit me up on any of the socials. Send me the name that you want to be credited as a honorary member of Zombie Squad. Send me your favorite one or two profile pictures, avatars, what have you, your profile pictures on Instagram, Facebook, whatever, and we can squad you up. I will make you an honorary member of the Zombie Squad, and I'll design all this stuff. I'll design a t-shirt, I'll design your logo, your whole Zombie Squad kind of profile if you want to be an honorary member of Zombie Squad, and give you the options to buy a t-shirt, to buy a phone case, to buy a pillow, to buy a tapestry, to buy a hoodie, to whatever the hell you want. But if you want to be a honorary member of the Zombie Squad, let me know. And
they gotta put in the work though.
All they have to do is send me one or two of their profile pics, and they'll be an honorary member of the Zombie Squad.